The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. We are in a revolution, the fourth industrial revolution to be exact. The term was coined in 2016 by Klaus Schwab, the founder of the World Economic Forum, in a book of the same name. According to Schwab, the fourth industrial revolution creates a world in which virtual and physical systems of manufacturing cooperate with each other in a flexible way at the global level. The fourth industrial revolution is often talked about in cyber-physical systems. Think large-scale machine-to-machine communication of internet-enabled smart devices to automate, produce, monitor, analyze, diagnose, and decide without the need for human intervention. Each cycle is called a revolution for a reason. Revolution is defined as rapid change, often supplanting systems that came before. The first industrial revolution of the 18th and early 19th century introduced mechanization and innovations such as a steam-powered engine. The second industrial revolution of the 19th and early 20th century introduced mass production and assembly lines powered by electricity. And the third, in the late 1960s, brought about computers and digital automation. Each successive technical revolution evolved at a faster pace and acted as an accelerator for the next. The fourth is happening at an exponential rather than a linear pace and disrupting almost every industry. At each successive cycle, we humans have doubled down on our quest to control our environment and to engineer our future. The last century is nothing if not a testimonial to that quest. In fact, the more technology we have around us, the greater this belief. But what if this belief is an illusion? What are the consequences for us on how we view and manage change?
Our guest today is scholar, speaker, advisor, and author, April Rinney. April advises startups and established companies, local and national governments, policymakers, think tanks, and investors. Her areas of expertise include policy reform, global expansion, the future of work, travel and tourism, sustainable development, cities, and emerging markets. She is the author of Flux, 8 Superpowers for Thriving in Constant Change, released on August 24, 2021 by Penguin Random House. As a young global leader at the World Economic Forum, she leads the Sharing Economy Working Group and is a member of the Global Futures Council for the Future of Mobility and the Urbanization Advisory Group. April holds a JD from Harvard Law School and is a Fulbright scholar who has studied at Oxford University, Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and the European University Institute. Welcome, April.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So in a year where everyone feels like that everything is in flux and that our whole world is upside down, your new book, Flux, 8 Superpowers for Thriving in Constant Change, seems quite timely. And in your book, you talk about how the pace of change has never been as fast as it is today, and yet it likely never to be again this slow. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a great tee up. And I do want to just kind of call out, it's not lost on me for a minute what the last year has done or 18 months in terms of a world in flux. That said, I didn't write the book in 2020. I did, but I started it quite a bit before. I've been working on it since 2018 and was really looking at these broader kinds of flux and seismic changes and shifts that humans really aren't that prepared for. And then 2020 happened, and it has been this incredible kind of validation, but also acceleration of some of my ideas. And I do want to call out that what we're living through right now, it is a unique moment in time, as all moments in time are. But this concept of flux and an ever faster pace of change and how do we keep up with the world in flux and all of that, it's not going anywhere, even when COVID is whatever COVID is going to become, right? It's sort of here to stay and there's more of it moving forward. So to your question about, you know, the pace of change. So it has, we think about just in terms of how quickly things can change. And I love that you teed up Professor Schwab, and I'm part of the World Economic Forum and know his work quite well. If you think about the first industrial revolution, it took the better part of a century, basically five generations to play out, right? To really fully feel the effects of it. You had people moving from farmland to cities. I mean, you had things that took more time. The fourth industrial revolution is playing out before our very eyes. And I don't have, no one has the exact number, amount of time it's going to take, but it's less than a generation, right? And you think about just the compression of how many things are being disrupted, transformed, changed in that period of time. You go, oh my goodness, yes, the pace of change, it is fast. And we can measure this in terms of amount of information we try to consume every day or that's produced every day. Climate changing, I mean, that's kind of metaflux, if you will. Lots of different metrics we could use, but that pace of change, it's never been, it's as fast as it's ever been. And yet it's unlikely to ever again be this slow. And I think, you know, Alexa teed it up really well in terms of moving forward. You tell me something that's going to slow the pace of change. I'm not sure what it is, right? It's going to have to drop from the sky. Or even what's interesting, the pandemic in many ways slowed life down. It kind of screeched us to a halt in some ways. But think about the pace of change overall. Think about when we're reemerging, reopening, whatever we want to call it. Massive change has happened personally, organizationally, societally, in these 12 to 18 months. So when I tease this out, you know, pace of change has never been as fast as it is today. It's never again going to be this slow. On the one hand, it is kind of exciting. Like, wow, more change ahead, right? But on the other hand, it's kind of terrifying, right? And I say this because we can tease out a few different themes, but one is that, you know, this notion of we're just supposed to keep up with the pace of change. We're just supposed to keep running faster, keep up, keep going, run. I get deeply concerned if we continue the narrative of run faster, just keep up, and we know that the future is just more change. I mean, we're looking at best, this is massive burnout and exhaustion, which we're already seeing to some degree. But more broadly, what we're looking at is a society in which no one has the opportunity to reach their full potential because we're all just completely overwhelmed with trying to react to change, digest it, you know, and haven't actually slowed down enough to pay attention to what really matters.
So I was assuming that I was just getting old. So now I feel better. It's not me. It's actually everything is moving a lot faster. So we're already sort of challenged by the fact that things are changing so very quickly. And then the inconceivable happened 18 months ago. I can still finger the week in the calendar where exactly all the things you thought could never happen happened in terms of borders closing, in terms of things being canceled, in terms of whatever. And once you remove that constraint that you thought that could never happen, and that then you wonder what next, right? What could happen next? And so if that's been a wake-up call and change everything that we've experienced in the pandemic, then and change that we can't impact, we cannot control, what can we do or why is it that we struggle so much with change and how do we cope?
Yeah. So I do want to tee up a little bit, and this is more like kind of healthy debate, if you will. So a lot of people today know me as a futurist. And as a futurist, you're sort of trying to map out scenarios. What could possibly happen, right? And I think, I mean, we didn't know that it would be a pandemic that is called COVID that is, you know, played out as it did. But this whole notion of, I think we really, as a futurist, totally saw that this, something right. like this could happen.
Sure.
Right. And now we're all like, whoa, it could happen. And I don't want to say it could just happen. Yes, the last 12 to 18 months have been a huge wake-up call. I actually think they've also been a bit of a warm-up, a wake-up and a warm-up of the kinds of things that are going to happen more. And I don't mean that in a kind of Debbie Downer or dystopian way. There are lots of great changes out there too, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But this whole notion that because of the faster pace of change and the faster pace of transformation and disruption and like things can happen, what we've experienced over the last year or year and a half, get ready for more of that. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is something that humans are fundamentally, I don't want to say hardwired this way, but like we've been socialized and taught and normalized this sense that we have the ability to predict and control and engineer the future. And nothing could be further from the truth. So where do we go? Like we struggle with change. And yes, humans' relationships to change are messy and complicated and really beautiful for that, I think. Every human on the planet, and you know, I haven't met everybody, but everyone that I've met, like I've been researching this for the better part of 25 years. Every human loves certain kinds of change and hates other kinds of change. We embrace some change, we really resist, or you know, our brains get hijacked around other kinds of change. So for me, even my book, you know, people say, oh, you wrote a book about change, or you wrote a book about change management. I'm like, no, I wrote a book about humans' relationship to change and how messy and complicated and beautiful they are, but that for the most part, our relationship to change is framed by this assumption that we can predict and control the future and kind of engineer what's going to happen to us. And nothing could be further from the truth. Neither you nor I nor anyone can control the future. We can only control what we, how we respond. And I think a lot of people will have heard of that. But when it comes to trying to forecast where is the future heading, no one can predict or engineer the exact future as it plays out, but we all have this illusion that we think we can. What we can do, however, is decide whether and how to contribute to a future scenario possibility that we'd like to see happen, right? And so as we think about, you know, the first step for me in our struggle with change is I find that most people, we spend a lot of time, and here, you know, I include myself for most of my life. It's not like I'm not talking about others and I'm somehow different. I am exhibit A, I am the guinea pig for a lot of what I'm working on. But that sense that we've been taught that humans have this ability to control, that we are, and in fairness, we are the one species, as far as we know, that can, that may be able to destroy the very environment that keeps us alive. There's an unintended consequence big time right there. But what most, so we spend a lot of time thinking about how am I going to manage change? How am I going to react to it? How am I going to triage it? But we don't actually think much about the inner, the relationship to change from the inside out. Like, what are my emotions about this? What's driving me to believe that, right? So what we've been dealt in the last year, year and a half is this incredible opening, this window of opportunity to reset how we think about and relate to change much more holistically. And so I find that most people, they're too busy reacting to change, responding to it, just trying to get through the day to day, that they don't pause to actually think about, whoa, where is some of this coming from in terms of how I relate emotionally, intellectually, in my relationships and so forth. And we need to actually start with that from the inside out to then be able to show up more fully for change in all its various forms moving forward. So we can talk about some of the practicalities and how do you do that? Where do you start? But I just want to put out there first, there's like this baseline we need to get to around, have you, you, and I say this, you know, whoever's listening, have you really thought about your relationship to change in its messy, complicated, multifaceted, uniquely you way?
I know that I try to compartmentalize and say, there are things that I know, I have no idea what's going to happen, but there are my coping mechanism, and it's my coping mechanism is, you know, assuming that, well, whatever else happens, I can at least do X, like, you know, cross the border to Canada, for instance, which is why it's shocking when that suddenly becomes a non-option. But I mean, that doesn't take away anything from what you said.
I was thinking as I was researching, April, your writings and some of the chapters in your book, which you were kind enough to send us, I did not think of change that way. In other words, I thought about how much we talk about how technology is changing the world and how the effects of technology. In fact, even this podcast, we talk about the consequences, intended or unintended, of technology. And in a way, it frames the situation as if we are a passive participant. And yet, you know, if you think a little deeper about it, technology doesn't by itself change anything. It's sort of like it's a tool. It is a consequence of our design, of our intention. And it is intended to achieve something. You know, sometimes it doesn't. And this, we've got an unintended consequence. And it's sometimes intended or used for really noble or horrifying intentions alike. It's not that the technology is changing the world. It's actually the people and their ingenuity, their use of it, their imagination, their avarice.
Hubris, put hubris on the list.
Hubris too, of who build and design it. So I think this is why it fascinates me when you say, when you talk about this illusion, the belief that we have that we can control, that it's an illusion, and that it's dangerous. Talk to us about why that is dangerous.
Yeah. Oh, Alexa, well, both of you, I love how you've teed this up. And you're absolutely right. And I'll dive into that. I want to zoom out just for a minute to frame a little bit of what you were saying as well, because it's all, so much of this is about control. And what we believe we can control versus what we actually may or may not be able to control, which at the end of the day is very little. And technology plays a key role in this. But what I want to say, it's the sort of framing of pause for a moment. And if you're listening, you know, pause and think about the changes you love. Just write a list of them down, right? Like make a T-chart, right? Piece of paper, line down the middle, line across the top, left hand, changes you love, right hand changes you hate. Just write them down as we're talking and then start to notice what do they have in common. And one of the biggest themes or characteristics, I would say, that I find time and time again, we tend to love those changes we opt into. So a new relationship, a new job, a new food to eat, a new place to visit, a new whatever, like. And it can even be an unwelcome, like a hard change. Like I'm going to lose weight, for example, but I'm choosing it.
Right, right.
That we love. We tend to really, really struggle with changes we can't control. So the kind of change that blindsides you on a Tuesday afternoon, it goes against your assumptions and expectations. It disrupts your plans. And again, here I would say even a change we know is good for us. If it's not expected and not welcomed, right? So think about this. And more than any other single factor, I would say that belief that we can control, opt in, hinges on so much else. I've also heard, I love this phrase, so I'll just toss it out there, like humans love change, we hate being changed. So we love the noun, we hate the verb. I mean, lots of ways we can tee this up, but I challenge everyone who's listening to just think through, does this align with your experience, right? Because all somehow, of a sudden, it's way more complicated. Yeah, go ahead.
Somehow what's running through my brain is this notion of, but honey, you said you wanted X, right? You know, the helpful partner that said, here, we're going to go, but it's not so helpful and wonderful if you didn't want to do it. So.
Exactly. And then though we add this layer of technology. And again, I mean, my husband is a technologist. I am not an anti-tech. I use technology like the rest of us, but to your point, Alexa, it is a means, not an end in and of itself. It is all about intentions in terms of you can use tech. And here, beyond devices and apps and digital technologies, technology includes things like knives and spoons and forks. Like a knife was very innovative when it came out. It's technology. A knife can be used to cut food. A knife can be used to kill people. Like, I mean, this is not a new thing to the 21st century or anything like that. But what modern technologies have done to us, I believe, and I'll show a little bit of my, you know, bias or just be a bit provocative here, is that the more devices we have, the more tools we have, the more apps we have access to, the more we have come to believe that we actually can control what's going on. So, whatever it may be, can't find my way, my GPS will fix it. That's a very simple example. But like, whatever problem I have, there's an app for that. And yet, what I find time and time again, the more, and here I shouldn't say addicted, the more reliant we become on digital technologies, the belief we have that they might solve a problem. And I'm not saying they're not helpful. They can be very, very helpful. But at the end of the day, any belief that this technology can somehow control the future or make a change that is bound to happen, simply not happen, that is misguided. That is misplaced. And I do think that the last year has shown us to a little bit, you know, a window into how wrong, how misguided that is. Because what I find is that the more people relied on technology before the pandemic hits, and then they realize no amount of anything, like there is no app that's going to let me travel again. There's no app that's going to protect me from a pandemic. Like there's nothing. I actually have to get clear with myself. I have to reshape how I relate to myself and how I show up in the world. That was a really helpful change, if you will, around how we think about what we ultimately can control. And it's quite limited at the end of the day. And so that's where, you know, the framing around intentions cannot be underscored enough. But again, when we think about our relationship to change, and this is what I love, like we can have intentions about how we relate and show up to change itself. And the intentions are game changers. This is the difference between seeing change as an opportunity versus a threat. It's the difference between deciding that a change is going to doom me for the rest of my life, or that this thing that changed that didn't go the way that I thought, it's actually a window for me to improve and go learn and do something else. You know, it plays out in all these different ways. But technology gets really, it's sort of wedged in there. And I think much more today than it would have been, for example, in the first Industrial Revolution. It was there, it was definitely there, but its impact was not felt at the same pace that it is today.
So new technologies, all the apps that you're talking about, a lot of them are the social media where we connect with one another. And it has actually made it very simple for people who'd never met one another to establish trust. Sometimes that trust and that depth of relationship is more than what we have with immediate family members or even, you know, friends we've had for a long time. That by itself is still a sea change that would have been unheard of 50 years ago. So in a way, you know, our relationship with trust has changed. You make some observations in your book about trust and about how we ought to, about the value of trust. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm looking at everything these days against this backdrop of how do certain themes or concepts or things help us relate to change in a more healthy, productive way, right? And it's fascinating. I'll tee it up by saying trust is a lever around which so much else revolves. And much of that, we don't even necessarily notice it until it's not there. And so just think about when change hits. To whom or to what do you turn? I would argue that most people turn to their trusted relationships. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have many, you're in a world of hurt that you wouldn't be otherwise. And yet trust is this kind of slippery thing that we talk about, you know, corporations say, trust us to know what's best for you. And, you know, as customers or consumers, we're like, I don't know about that. You know, trust is the most valued resource in an organization, yet we cannot measure it in dollars and cents.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just really interesting. But when change hits, and this is again one of those things that I think silver lining is a loaded term. I know we're all kind of grappling with what were the silver linings of 2020 and so forth, but this wake up around the immeasurable value of trust as we're in the midst of a global trust crisis. I think, you know, it can't be understated. And you're right, technology, I mean, my work in the early sharing economy and all of that, I mean, at the 50-yard line of seeing how technology can help build trust that otherwise we would have no way of identifying, no way of nurturing. Fabulous, right? I mean, absolutely, the intentions behind that development, we want more of that.
And yet I still see that there are technology and it's a way to actually enable us to trust, cause problems, because we had lots of people who trusted information that was delivered on various social media platforms by people who supposedly were in positions of authority, and it got us into a whole world of hurt as well.
Correct. And so I'm saying there, and again, I'm saying there was, from in terms of trust, there are lots of examples we can point mm-hmm. to where technology has enabled people to trust genuinely and, you know, responsibly right. that wouldn't have happened before. And right. we've also designed technology systems, come back to this in a minute, all kinds of instances in which we've been led to an illusion of trustworthiness, but right. in fact, it's empty behind. So again, right. it cuts both ways. The piece I want to tee out though, or to the piece I want to dig into is, and I spend some time on this in the book, but it's the way we design. Mm-hmm. And here I say the way we design our organizations, our systems, our institutions, our apps, our, you know, monetary system. I mean, lots of different things that we have, on the whole, we have designed our world from the basic default assumption that the average individual cannot be trusted.
Yeah.
So the three of us today, on average, you should not be trusting me right now, and I should not be trusting you. That's what society tells me, right? I don't know you. I mean, I do. I really yeah. know you. Wow. What have we just done? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't trust that kids are curious enough to learn on their own. So we put them in mandatory schooling. I happen to be trained as a lawyer, and I will be the first to call out the legal system. It's the rule of law is really important. But when we've designed an entire legal system that the only way we think we can get people to cooperate is to threaten lawsuits, we've broken human relationships, right? The legal system is designed for mistrust. And what I'm trying to tee up here, and it's all technology. We can look at layers in which this happens.
Cybersecurity, zero trust model.
Yeah. And this sense of, have we really become so disillusioned with ourselves? And I'm not saying just humanity, like, is this really how we want to be treated as individuals? And what the shift that I'm looking at is, what's the difference? We have designed so many things from the basic assumption of mistrust, untrustworthiness, humans are not to be trusted. And yet we've actually cut off all kinds of genius and curiosity. We've created really expensive systems to maintain. I'm looking at this from the perspective of, this is not blind trust or naive trust. And I'm not saying that bad things can't happen and there aren't bad apples in the bunch, but I'm saying, what happens if we treat those instances as the exception rather than the rule? Because what we've got today is the rule is you can't be trusted. And if you're one of the lucky ones, then you can be. But we've designed so much goodness out of our systems. What would it look like if we learned to what we call design from trust?
So the interesting thing there, though, is that the internet is actually effectively designed from trust, right? And the only way you could set up a globe-spanning network 40 years ago was actually to have networks that would pass traffic and share traffic and send it along its way in an unmolested fashion. And it's ironic because now everyone's rushing to try to retrofit all kinds of, you know, security systems onto this astonishing architecture that was created with a lack of you know, security measures, because everyone trusted everyone else, and clearly not everyone is trustworthy, which, you know, the sad thing is, it's true, not everyone is trustworthy, and there are bad actors, but there are decades literally of experience of how much was achieved through collaboration, and not just cooperation, but collaboration and trust. And, you know, literally passing packets through your network onto the network in an unmolested fashion, that meant we could not otherwise have had a globe-spanning network in that kind of time frame. So
absolutely.
It's an interesting question. If we could, you know, not lose that, even as we have to acknowledge that there's an awful lot of malicious traffic out there by the few bad actors that are out there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I was not part of the early, early internet crowd, but have some friends and colleagues and mentors who were, and that sense that, and that, that sentiment, that capability, that memory, that collective, it's very alive and well, right? There is this sense. And I think what's interesting, and I hope this isn't too much of a tangent, but I've had conversations recently with young people, people again, born this century, let's say, right? They do not know the internet history, and they learn about it. And they're like, yeah, that, like, that's what we want. Like, wow. And they have no idea. They assume that, and again, this is a broader conversation, I suppose, but what we have normalized and what we have come to believe is like, this is just the way it is. And then you realize right. This is not the way it was or is at all. It certainly isn't the way it has to be. And so right. For sure, I wish we could, if you could unwind the clock, what would you have put in place way back when? I mean, that's trying to predict the future, which isn't possible, but this sense and the pieces of what you're describing, they're still there. Right. It's just more of the, how do we, what is, well, I guess I could ask you guys a question as well. As we think about that path forward, what is the role of technology versus like just the role of humans connecting right. as humans? And we've snipped, I think, so many relationships that used to keep trust together, that used to help us navigate change and so forth. And now there's much more of this, like, me and my device and I'll figure it out. And, you know, I do think a lot about the balance, the healthy balance between technology and human relationships without the need for any technology moving forward.
Yeah. So it's an interesting point because in a large sense, everyone has said, well, you know, the internet, that was fine for how the internet ran as a research network, but now it has to grow up and the management of the system must grow up and be more mature. So that lack of trust is being equated with maturity, or maturity is being equated with, you know, don't trust anyone. So it's interesting to hear the counter arguments and how can we take those lessons and drive them back?
Well, and I'm thinking, again, perhaps a little, it's not a tangent. The moment you said that, the moment I was immediately like, wow, there's a parallel here with our curiosity as well. And kids versus adults. And you think about, you know, we have these, the moment we introduce mistrust of the average individual, we kill curiosity really, really well.
Yes, that's true.
And you think about children and it's like, oh, why as adults, why have we tracked into these lanes that we assume, whether it's climbing the corporate ladder or opting only into a certain social circle, or like, I do this, I don't do that. Like, how did that happen? Right. It's, and not to sound naive, it's not like children have it all figured out either, but this, it's crazy. Children are not born wishing badly of other humans. You learn to, you know, for me, it's, you trust responsibly. You don't trust blindly. You do your homework, right?
Yeah. Trust but verify. I love that. I love that concept because it's still human, right? But at the same time, it says, don't be stupid, you know, exercise critical thinking, which I think we've also lost as well. April, talk to us about a couple, at least we talked about start with trust. That was one of your superpowers. Another one, which was very intriguing for me, was see what is invisible. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Oh, this is fun. So another one of the 8 flux superpowers is see what's invisible, which says that in a world that feels uncertain or where the future is blurry, focus not on what is straight ahead, front and center, which candidly is what society tells us to do. Focus on what's invisible, what's on the periphery, what's on the edges, what you might not know, what might be right beyond the horizon. And that has lots of different manifestations. So one we could talk about probably, which we've already alluded to a little bit, so I'll pick up this baton and run with it, is just this concept of invisible value. And we are taught to value what we see, what is right in front of us, value what can be measured, value what we can put in dollars and cents. And yet, and as I just said, like, trust, the most valuable asset or resource you've got, can't put a dollar, can't put a monetary figure on it. That's a great example, actually, of invisible value that when, again, my backdrop for all of this is, how do we navigate change? When you navigate change well, those people who can, quote unquote, see what's invisible and harness it are going to be so much better placed. So this sense, and I say this as a futurist, where a lot of times I'm told, actually, Professor Schwab said this to me years ago. I took it as a compliment, but he said, like, I just don't know what to do with people like you. Like, you're looking at everything that's not in the bullseye, that's not in the front and center, that's not quarterly returns and whatever. But he said, I know that without some people like you in this community, we have no future. Because I'm looking at stuff that's like on the periphery. It's like fringe. It's alternative. Even when I was in the early sharing economy, I was written off left, right, and center. People saying, that is crazy. We will never share our cars. We will never go in someone's house. Like, crazy. You're foolish.
Someone coming to my house? Are you kidding me?
And that's trust. And that's so invisible value. Also, great example. Most people were like, and certainly traditional companies, hotels, that sort of thing. And here I'm very much talking about Airbnb and the home sharing phenomenon. And I say bona fide home sharing, not corporate lets, but like sharing an extra room in your house. Everyone wrote that off as like, that has no value. That's like foolish. And that's, you can't trust anybody, et cetera. Well, lo and behold, what did the founders of Airbnb do? They saw, seeing what's invisible, they saw value that other people wrote off. They saw value in excess space in people's homes. And they built a business around it that is now larger than the 5 largest hotel chains on the planet combined. So that's really interesting. And then, you know, we can take this back to change, where when you're able to see what's invisible, you actually develop the ability to, the easiest way to put it is, it gives you more flexibility. It gives you more nimbleness and agility, because you're actually able to see not only what others are seeing, but you're able to see beyond that. And here we can talk about peripheral vision. I mean, there's a whole other angle to this as well that has to do with expanding our peripheral vision. So when we get nervous or anxious, literally our peripheral vision narrows and we develop what's called tunnel vision. That's a thing, and it's called that because it means we're really under stress. And yet when change hits, what we need to do is the exact opposite. We need to expand our peripheral vision and figuratively expand the universe of opportunities and the universe of options that we have at our disposal.
So we're sadly just about at time, but I can't let you go without asking you about one of the other flux superpowers, let go of the future. What is it and why does it help us with uncertainty?
Yeah, so this is, it's the last one in the book, but you actually can read the book in any order you want. The superpowers stand on their own. So if that one appeals to you, start with chapter 8 first. And what I love is this is actually all about our relationship to control. So coming full circle, but people often say, like, you're a futurist. You can't say let go of the future. Like, that's crazy. They don't understand what I mean here. When I say let go of the future, I do not mean giving up. I do not mean failing. I do not mean throwing in the white towel. I mean, we are so, pardon my speech, we are so hellbent on wanting to control and predict the future, and I need it to play out just this way, that we're actually getting ourselves in a major mess. When I say let go of the future, we need to be able to let go in order to let a better future emerge. A lot of this is about getting out of our own way. Mm-hmm. And so rather than saying, it's all up to me, I have to predict and control what happens, that if not, my life is basically, you know, shattered. This is where we start getting into, again, as a futurist, into the realm of scenario planning. Rather than saying it's the future and it must go this way, I need to actually start preparing for a whole bunch of different futures that could happen. I don't get to control any one of them, but I certainly can be prepared for many of them. And when you can learn to let go in that way, what you find is not that your life is doomed or anything like that. People often find a sense of peace and a bit of relief, a kind of like, oh, I need to actually just be able to lean into what's happening, as opposed to trying to as opposed to setting myself up for if it goes this way, I'll be fine. And any other thing is disaster. So there's a fun kind of, you know, there's, like I said, these superpowers are counterintuitive. They're a little bit contrarian. Letting go of the future is actually incredibly empowering when you can do it. It's not a letting go as we think about it traditionally in terms of failure. It's actually the ability to breathe. I frame it as kind of the ability to breathe oxygen and create space for new futures to emerge.
I think those are wise words for the control freaks amongst us, and I'm not going to name names.
don't be pointing your finger at me, Alexa. It's been a really fun discussion, and certainly very useful pointers for people to deal with whatever they're experiencing in the course of this pandemic. And we'll all look forward to reading your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you both. Thank you. This has been absolutely delightful.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.